I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, I'm going to talk with poet Ruby Orozco Santos. She is an El Paso poet and just came out with a new book called Inventos Míos. And we're going to talk a little bit about her poetry. So stick around. But after my interview with Ruby, I am going to answer the two most frequently asked questions that writers get. If you're a writer, you know that every time you do a presentation and there's a question and answer period, you get the same two questions. They are the most common ones. I'm not going to tell you yet what they are. After the interview, not only will I tell you what those two most common questions are, but I will answer them according, obviously, to my perspective. And then I will invite writers to submit their answers to those two questions. This will be after my interview with Ruby. But first, let's talk to this fantastic new poet, Ruby Orozco Santos. Ruby Orozco Santos was first published in the Border Voices Anthology. She has practiced writing in El Paso's TumbleWords Project and served as editor of Border Sense's literary magazine. She has been an active member of the Bobbed Wire Open Mic Series and was awarded the Artist Incubator Program grant by the El Paso Museums and Cultural Affairs Department, making possible this first book of poems, Inventos Míos. Ruby Orozco Santos, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I've known you for years. I knew you when you were a student here years and years ago. And you used to hang out with some of the MFA students. And
yes.
But apparently you've taken creative writing when there were writers that aren't here anymore. You mentioned specifically in your book, in your introduction, you talk about taking classes with Zapata.
And yes.
Connie
We're still in touch. Connie. Mm-hmm.
Connie Wasim, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that was a while back. How were those classes?
Oh, they were lovely. They were fantastic. That must have been either the very late 90s or early 2000s at UTIP. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I was part of the literary community and local reading since really since I was in high school.
Yeah, and you've not only been part of the literary community for a long time, but you've also been a very active activist. You're an activist in El Paso, and you get behind a lot of important issues for our community. And you've been doing that for a while now, haven't you? And how does that relate it to your poetry, do you think?
Well, I think it's related in just using my voice, you know, having something inside that I can't keep inside and needing to express my position on things or support causes with my words or my actions. I think it's all kind of from the same source.
Right, right. Yeah. In fact, as I read your fantastic new book, Inventos Míos, I'm struck with a lot of the imagery and a lot of the themes of the poetry seem to be related to what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis as an activist. And now, you know, lately, I think the last several years, as an indigenous food activist. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. I think I've been nursing a wound, like a soul wound of loss of, language, like indigenous language in my family lineage. My great-grandmother spoke Nahuatl, but she didn't teach my grandma, and so the rest of us didn't get to learn it. And we were lucky that we learned a lot of traditional foods, recipes and ways of, you know, working with plants from my grandmother. But there's a lot that we didn't get, you know. And so I think that's part of what drives my work around education and around ancestral food ways and knowledge. I'm kind of obsessed with learning about the histories of different foods. I'm a trained health educator, and we get trained to know about like the protein content and the nutrients of foods. But I'm interested in the stories of the foods, you know, and also learning about how some of our foods were kind of demeaned or undervalued, you know, during colonization. And so, for example, in the chronicles, in the reports back to the King of Spain in the early 1500s, the conquistadores would write, you know, about everything, including foods. And they would say things like that nopales were a monstrous plant. <You know? laughs> understand that, you know, that spirulina has a very poor taste. It's an algae. And that, you know, we know because as Spaniards, our palate knows what's good and what's bad, you know. Yeah. And so there's a lot of very interesting history. And so that's what inspired this book. It's about the history and practice of nixtamalization, which is the practice of cooking corn in an alkaline solution and then letting it soak in that solution long enough for the corn to get very starchy and fat and break through the pericarp, like the little peel. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, not only is it easier to grind if you're going to make tortillas or tamales, but it's also more nutritionally enhanced. So now you have calcium, now you have niacin. And niacin is very important because if corn is your main grain in a population, if you don't nixtamalize it, you'll create a niacin deficiency in the population, and people will get sick. They'll get an illness called pellagra, and it causes skin lesions, it causes dementia, eventually death. And so when the Spanish took corn back to the old world, they didn't take the process of nixtamalization with it, and so they wanted to use it to famine in Europe, but they ended up creating more problems than 200 years of pellagra outbreaks because they didn't ask or value this system, this science, right, that the indigenous people of the Americas knew to do.
That is fascinating. Nixtamalización.
Yeah.
And that process, as you describe it, it sounds like almost like there's a spiritual transformation going on at the same time as there is the literal transformation of the food.
I love that you said that. Yes, I feel like the corn is in I'm into meditation and yoga, so to me it feels like the corn is sitting there meditating and expanding and transforming itself.
Yeah.
And preparing itself to serve others, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, there's so much richness in the process, and there's a lot of imagery and metaphors, and just like memory, you know, awakening memories you didn't know you had when you look at the tools, when you smell the scents and listen to the people. I interviewed people in El Paso who still nixtamalize their own corn at home and grind it.
Have you ever done it?
I have, yes, I have. And I used to help my grandmother do it when I was little, but it had been a while, and this really reconnected me with that tradition.
Well, you know, there's this image in a Sandra Cisneros poem. I don't recall the exact poem or even the exact image, but it has to do with a woman cutting vegetables. And you can't help but to feel like as that woman is cutting vegetables, that she's connecting to the antepasados and possibly even connecting to, you know, to future manifestations of will and spirit. And and I imagine as you're taking part in the nixtamalización, that there must be some sense that you're moving your hands and your arms in the same way as the ancestors.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, there is a body memory, right? And I actually wrote a poem about it. I sat down with a good friend who's a physical therapist, and I had taken pictures and some short film clips of the people who I interviewed.
Uh-huh.
And so there, you know, when you see a master like cyclist, they just won with their machine.
Right.
She was like that with her molino,
oh, no
with
way.
The handmill, you know, she knew exactly where to put her feet and her body and how to approach it. And so I sat down with my physical therapist friend and asked her to help me break down the body movement, you know?
Oh, wow. The poem on page 20 about the origins of nixtamalización, this is a poem about that process. Can you tell us how you arrived at such a weird poem? It's kind of a weird poem. It's like, let's talk in grass, it is, and then you have the knot going one way, linear. Is this poem in a way of representing rhythmically the process?
Well, I feel like a part of the theme maybe of the overall book is I have training as a health educator in public health in a kind of Western science thinking.
Uh-huh.
But this book is also like my ancestral indigenous soul voice, right?
Right, absolutely.
So the poem Let's talk in graphs, and there's actually a couple of X and Y axes on the poem. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to trace the history of nixtamalization in this poem. Like, when did it start? I'm getting all my data points. Is it, you know, 1,200 years before Christ when the Olmecs were grinding oyster shells to cook their corn? Was that the first time? Or was it in Guatemala? I mean, there's no exact agreement on who or when it started, right? So I'm saying, let's talk in graphs. Let's put our data points. And that's where the X and Y axes came in. So is it linear? It's not linear. Is it a scattered plot? You know, what are the data points? And the poem really is about one of the books I read that said, maybe it was an accidental discovery. You know, maybe somebody just tripped over some ashes and then they realized the next day that the ashes that fell in this corn made it easier to grind. And so I'm refusing to accept that as a data point in the history.
That is ridiculous. And, you know what it's like? It's like, you know how when you walk through a place where there's a lot of plant life, a lot of vegetation, and you begin to wonder about how long it took human beings to know that to eat of this plant is nutritious and to eat of this plant is poisonous, that, you know, that maybe how many people had to die before they knew that. But then there's this idea as well that the human beings from which we come, our antepasados, just knew this stuff in their souls. And it wasn't an accident. They didn't have to die a thousand times before they learned, don't eat that. They just knew it.
Yes. And there's a certain communing or listening to nature that can happen, you know, and anyone who's studied with a yerbera would learn, you know, about this kind of sitting with plants and connecting with them. And, you know, definitely there's a deep connection between the human and the animal and plant world, if you have the patience develop that skill.
You know what I love about this book? I mean, I love the book in general, Inventos Míos. I'm talking to Ruby Orozco Santos. Her book, Inventos Míos, is now available. It's a book of poems. And at the end, you have the acknowledgement page, agradecimientos. And I love the very first entity, I guess, that you thank. You say, gracias al maíz por invitarnos a crecer juntos. You're
yes,
thanking
absolutely.
Corn. The very first one you thank is corn.
Yes. You know, corn, it evolved out of a wild grass called teosintle that just has one row of teeth. And people, I mean, there's different stories, but one of the stories is that we watched the ants get the teosintle grains and learn from the ants. And there's a bigger story about Quetzalcoatl being part of that process. But yeah, it's a plant that we evolved with. You know, we picked the starchiest grains and planted it and nurtured it. And until now, we have all these varieties of corn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then even, of course, the last poem is about corn. It's called Teosintle.
Uh-huh.
Which is what you were just talking about.
Yes.
So yeah, corn is very important. But there's also another incredible important aspect of this, and that is, I think, represented not only in the poems, but in the dedication. Would you be willing to read the dedication aloud, Para mi abuelita ame?
Sure. It says, Para mi abuelita ame, un día me dijiste que si hubieras tenido estudio, hubieras sido escritora. Mis primeras células dentro de ti se empaparon de ese mismo llamado.
And essentially it's saying that your grandmother told you that had she had been able to study, that she would have been a writer. And that inside you, very first cells, I guess, say the same thing, that you are, in your heart, a writer.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's very clear with these poems. They're beautiful poems. It's a beautiful book. It's called Inventos Míos. Before we say goodbye, Ruby, can we have you read one of the poems?
Yes, I'm going to read Movement at the Mill.
Okay.
Movement at the Mill. Feet are hip distance apart, steadily planted, knees slightly bent, legs hold purposeful, swaying. From the hips up, there is movement. Note that it originates inside the ribcage through her right arm. She leans into it. Flexion and extension of the right shoulder. flexion and extension of supinated forearm, flexion of fingers around handle, brief extension of fingers at extension of shoulder and forearm. Wrist flexes at bottom of rotation, pulls up in extension. Note left arm, how it rhythmically moves to balance. Relaxed arm balances movement. Note left hand, how at intervals it adjusts the bowl. Note left fingers pressing into mill. Right depth protects fingers from being ground. Note relationship of table to torso. Right height protects body from repetitive movement injury. Indigenous ergonomics, also known as simply caring about the person. Note expansion of understanding. Right relationship of observing to practicing ensures skill set, protects lineage from dark age ahead.
That was Ruby Orozco Santos reading from her new book, Inventos Míos. Ruby, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
It's an honor. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Ruby for joining us on Words on a Wire. And as I promised at the beginning of the show, I am now going to reveal the two most common questions that writers get. As you know, writers don't just write books, but we do readings. We have to do readings in order to get our work out there. We visit universities and colleges and community centers. This year alone, I've probably done about 10 different readings, visiting different parts of the country, and sometimes even international. This last summer, I had a reading in Salamanca, Spain, and that was interesting. But usually after a reading, we allow for questions, and I'm going to reveal right now the two most frequently asked questions of writers. If you're a writer, you know what these two questions are. And even if you're not a writer, you could probably guess because it might be the first question that comes to you when you think about ask a writer a question. Now, the first most common question that writers get is, if you were an ice cream, what flavor would you be? And I usually answer, no, okay, I'm kidding. That's not really a question that we get asked. The number one question writers get, drumroll please, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Where do you get your ideas? I don't care where you do presentations, colleges, high schools, the most prestigious universities in the world. If there's a question session at the end of the reading, you will probably get that question. Where do you get your ideas? And of course, every writer has his or her own way of answering this question. But I always answer the question like this. And maybe the answer will surprise you. Who knows? My answer to the question, where do you get your ideas, is I don't get ideas. I try to get rid of ideas. I try to eliminate ideas. And I'm not exaggerating when I say this, but the fact is, when you are a writer, you essentially live the life of a writer. We're constantly bombarded with this creative energy and creative thought. So, for example, just sitting at a traffic light, you might look over at the car next to you, and maybe it's a Toyota pickup, and inside on the driver's seat, there's a man with a beard who looks like Santa Claus, and it's in the middle of summer, and his window's rolled down, and he's sweating, and he's listening to James Taylor on his stereo. And you start to think, wow, that could be Santa Claus on vacation or Santa Claus during the summer. Maybe he lives in El Paso. And you start to imagine what Santa Claus would do in the city when he's not working. What bars does he hang out at? What does he drink? And all these ideas just start to come to you. But, and this is an important thing, you don't write them down. You don't say, well, I need a pen or a pencil and I want to write down what does Santa Claus do when he's living in the city during the summer and it's really hot. Does he wear shorts? Does he wear a tank top? Does the hair stick out of his t-shirt? And I mean, you don't need to write that down, because the fact is, when you get to the next stoplight, you're going to have more ideas. Or when you're walking through the city, or when you're soaking your feet in a cold stream, ideas are going to stream into your mind. That's just the way it works when you write all the time. You can't help it, because I think one of the most fundamental aspects about being a writer is that you live as much as you can in the moment. And when you live in the moment, ideas are going to constantly come to you. So the fact is, I have more ideas than I have time to write about them, which is a good thing because not all the ideas, quite frankly, Daniel Chacon, are not that good. Everything that comes to my head, every idea I get may not necessarily be a very good idea. Like last night, I couldn't sleep very well and I was tossing and turning and I started to think about this story about a man who falls in love with a woman who is incredibly beautiful, but really, really mean. I mean, hugely mean. Shakespeare much, right? Taming of the Shrew, all ideas. There are no new ideas. But I started to think about this, and I thought, well, maybe he knows that she's got a good heart and there's something really beautiful about her because he's able to enter into her dreams. And then they meet in a dream. And I started to really figure out the entire narrative that he finds a door when he's dreaming, and that door enters into her dreams, and he meets her in there, and they have a great relationship in the dreams. But then when they wake up again, she's mean to him and doesn't want anything to do with him. But, you know, I don't know if that's a good idea. Probably not, but it's an idea. And I'm not going to write about that idea. I like what the great Argentinian poet Jorge Luis Borges says when he gets that question, and like I said, all writers get that question. Where do you get your ideas? Where do you get your ideas? He says that he doesn't write an idea unless it won't let him go. Because like all writers, he is bombarded with multiple ideas every day. Even now, sitting in the studio, looking at the window at our producer, Stefania Castro, giving me signals about how much time we have, I think of an idea. I mean, I think, well, I could write about that. But Borges said is he does not write an idea at all unless that idea won't let him go. If that idea wrestles him to the ground and makes him cry, uncle, write me, write me, write me, then he'll write about it. I remember one time I was in a department meeting at a university I used to teach in before UTEP, and I heard a voice, and this voice said, write me, write me, write me. And it was about this kid. And it was this kid who was mowing the lawn. And as he was mowing his lawn, rather than do it in lines, you know, like you do it in uniform lines just to make sure you get it all, he started to do it in like crazy zigzags and ended up spelling his name in the grass and thought that he had achieved some great work of art. And I just started writing it and writing and writing it. And that actually became how I opened my first novel, And the Shadows Took Him. So you never know when ideas are going to come. You never know when they're going to let you go. But the fact is, if you are a writer, you don't need to look for ideas. You need to get rid of ideas. Because for writers, it's not about the ideas. It's about the language. It's about the music. It's about the voice. When the voice of a character doesn't let you go and you start writing that voice, ideas come out organically. In fact, I think for a fiction writer and for a poet, idea-heavy writing is not a very good idea. I think the ideas should be organic to the voice. And like I said, you're going to be bombarded with ideas if you're a writer. So the answer to the first question, the number one question writers get, where do you get your ideas, is I don't get them. I try to get rid of them. And they get me and they wrestle me to the ground. The second question writers always get is, drum roll please, that's a really horrible, tacky drum roll, but it is, what do you do when you get writer's block? This question is usually asked by young people who want to be writers, or you know, people who are thinking about being writers. They say, well, you know, I want to be a writer, but I always get writer's block. And so they always ask, what do you do when you get writer's block? And I'll tell you right now, they do not like my answer. They never like my answer, because my answer is, I don't get writer's block. There's no such thing as writer's block. And you ask just about any published writer, there is frankly, no such thing as writer's block. I don't believe in it. I think writer's block is a creation of Hollywood narratives about writers who need to get ideas, and they're sitting before a blank page, or they're sitting before their computer and the cursor is blinking off and on, and they go, I don't know what to write. I don't have any ideas. That's not going to happen to a writer. Now, that will happen to non-writers who are thinking, wow, I want to write about something, but let me get a good idea. But as I said earlier, writers don't need to get ideas. We need to eliminate ideas. So I do not believe there is such a thing as writer's block. However, I do deeply believe that there is such a thing as writer laziness. Sometimes, quite frankly, I'm too lazy to write. And I sit before a blank computer screen or a blank white piece of paper, and I think, oh man, I just can't write. But it's not that I can't write. It's that I don't feel like writing. It's that I'm too lazy to write. It's that maybe I drank too much last night and my head is foggy, or maybe I had a bad dream and I was tossing and turning, or I couldn't sleep and I thought of a horrible idea about a man who falls in love with a beautiful woman who is really mean and can only meet her in a dream, which, you know, now that I think about that even more, really is an idea. And so I think that I have writer's block, but there is no such thing. You heard it here first, folks. There is no such thing as carpenter's block. There's no such thing as teacher's block, as lawyer's block, as doctor's block. And as I look into the window and see our producer, Stefania Castro, I can tell you right now, there is no such thing as producer's block. So why would there be something called writer's block? The fact is, there are times when you don't feel like working, and that's okay. Because if you don't feel like working, it's not writer's block. It's that you're just too lazy, or you have other things that you need to do. Maybe you have deadlines, you have to pay bills, or you have to go pick up your brother from the airport. I don't know. But during those times when I experience the complete lack of desire to write, it doesn't bother me. I'll take a walk. I'll take a drive. I'll soak my feet in cold creek water. I don't care. But the problem is, when I do these things, when I take a walk, and I walk a lot, most writers walk a lot, like the fiction writer Luisa Urrea says and said on this show, walking is writing. Even if you're not writing, walk. Even if you're not writing, read. Even if you're not writing, wash dishes. Yes, washing dishes is writing, in a sense. Because as you're doing this, as you're washing the dishes and you're looking out the window and you feel the hot water, the suds, and you're scrubbing dishes, you're going to be bombarded with ideas, more ideas, a bunch of ideas that you're going to try to eliminate. Because, again, if you wrote every idea you got, you're probably not a very good writer. But yeah, there is no such thing as writer's block. There is only such a thing as writer's reluctance to do much writing. So the two most common questions, where do you get your ideas? I don't get my ideas. I eliminate them. What do you do when you get writer's block? I don't get writer's block. I get writer's laziness or writer's reluctance to write. But the fact is, if I needed to write, if I were on a deadline, I don't care how reluctant I am to do so, I'm going to write. I just finished my final edits for my next book that's coming out in the fall. It's called Kafka in a Skirt, Stories from the Wall. And I had to rewrite a chapter or a story, and I didn't feel like it, but I had to do it, just like a carpenter has to go to work. So those are my answers, and I invite any writer who is listening right now, and I know we have a lot of writers that listen to this show, to submit your answers to those two questions. Where do you get your ideas, and what do you do when you have writer's block? Because I know not everybody is going to agree with me. Some people will have different ways of answering it, but answer that question. Write to me at Dan Chacon, DanChacon, at utep.edu, and tell me your answer to one or both of those questions, and I will take the best answers and I will read them on the air on a future show. And do not forget to answer the most important question writers get. If you were an ice cream, what flavor would you be? Personally, I think I would be Rocky Road. I love Rocky Road. And maybe there's a difference between, you know, what ice cream flavor do you love the most and what ice cream flavor would you be if you were riding? Because maybe I'd be coffee or espresso ice cream, which I really don't like, you know, but it's got a kick to it. And I would hope that every time you read a story or a novel by Daniel Chacón, it keeps you up at night thinking. I'm Daniel Chacón. I'd like to thank our guest today, Ruby Orozco Santos. The name of her book is Inventos Míos, and I don't suspect she had writer's block when she wrote this. And, of course, I'd like to thank, as always, our producer, Stefania Castro. So make sure you go out there and you write. See you next time on Words on a Wire.